Well, hello everyone. This is John Lachlan, Director of FED International. I'm speaking to you from Paris. Welcome to our Twitter space on the world financial crisis and particularly on the banking system. It's Thursday, the 15th of June. We're joined today by Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, can you hear us and are you there?
Yes, I can hear you quite clearly and I am here.
We're also joined by Richard Werner. I'm not sure how he likes us to pronounce his name. He's online. I think he can hear us, but he's perhaps not a speaker yet. I'm sure that'll be sorted out. Catherine, you've been on the Lachlan report with me. You were on, that's to say, on the televised interviews that I do occasionally from the studio in Amsterdam. You're a former Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the administration of George H.W. Bush. You became the managing director of Dillon Reed, an investment bank. And for, I think, 15 years now, you've run the Solari website, the Solari Report, which advises people on financial investments and on general current affairs. Catherine, since we spoke in November, on that occasion, we talked about CBDCs, about central bank digital currencies. There have been a number of banking collapses. Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, First Republic Bank, and of course Credit Suisse. How do we understand this? And how do we understand the fact that these banking crises seem to have passed without incident? They don't seem to have been contagious. Is the house of cards just getting bigger and bigger, or is it about to fall over?
So there's several things going on at once, John, but I wouldn't call them as collapses. I would call them as sort of pump and dumps targeting. And it looks to me as though an effort is being made to roll up the banking system, certainly in America, in the way that during the pandemic, the small business community was rolled up. So you're watching, coming into March of this year, you were watching the big banks losing deposits. And interestingly enough, the small and regional banks holding steady. And we saw several banks targeted that we know had in common a couple of characteristics, but one is they had enormous whale deposits. When the Federal Reserve and the G7 central bankers voted on the going direct reset in August 2019, what followed was an unprecedented injection of $5 trillion into the economy by the Fed, including directly, not going through the reserve track, but directly into the economy. And what emerged was these enormous whale deposits at some of the, say, the top 30 banks. And we've seen runs, three of the banks that came down at the beginning were banks that were both prototypes on the FedNow system, which is rolling out this summer, as well as were marked by these huge whale deposits. And they all were publicly traded. They experienced short selling. The American Bankers Association says that social media campaigns were started with disinformation to facilitate the short sellers, who made a great deal of money. We know when Silicon Valley Bank went down and was taken over by the regulators, the stock was still trading at over 100. So I'm exceptionally suspicious because it looks to me like you're watching a roll-up. I don't know as much about Credit Suisse, but clearly very harmed by the Russian sanctions. So we're in a situation where extraordinary politics are monkeying with or sort of forcing consolidation both of the small business and small farm, but also small banking. And I think it's imperative, and there's no one better than Richard Werner to talk about why it's absolutely imperative we not let that happen.
Well, Richard, actually, started, I went onto his website. Richard, I think you're with us now. Can you hear us?
Yes, indeed, I can. Thank you. Thanks for having
Very
me.
Very nice to have you again. We met earlier this year, or perhaps late last year, in Budapest. I believe you're still there, Richard.
Yes, indeed. Yes, reporting from Budapest.
Excellent. One of your most recent articles is on this subject. But before we, namely, should banks be allowed to fail? And you imply or say in your article what Catherine has just implied, which is that this is some kind of plot. In other words, that as Catherine has just said, that there is a plan to reduce the number of banks and that this is part of a larger plan. And And you say in your article in March that it's better to have more banks than fewer. But before I come to you, Richard, Catherine, can I just ask you, you say small banks have been targeted, but Credit Suisse is not a small bank.
Correct. So in the US, it was very interesting in March when you saw a series of banks in California, which are listed as in among the top 30 banks. You saw an enormous media campaign saying that small banks were in trouble as a result of the rise in interest rate and the weakness in loan portfolios, and a real effort to encourage people to, it was a real media campaign to get people to take their deposits out of the small banks, implying that's where the problem was. But if you look at the drop in deposits, it was in the big banks, not in the regional and small banks.
Richard, what do you make of these banking collapses? Are we, is this, and in particular, how do we understand the fact, is my first question to Catherine, how do we understand the fact that they don't seem to be contagious? We see these now four relatively, okay, the banks are different sizes, but relatively significant banking collapses. And yet the show seems to stay on the road. How do we understand this?
Well, I think it does support the thesis that these are targeted takedowns of banks. Overall, the decentralized banking system, consisting mainly of small banks that we have in the US, where there's 5,000 banks, the vast majority is very small local banks, is very resilient. So, you know, despite these targeted takedowns, the system is resilient. However, having said that, the fact is, and I'm really going to borrow a phrase that was thrown at me by an ECB person at a panel discussion last year when they were still denying the inflation that they've created. And they were arguing, well, inflation is a social construct. We shouldn't worry about it. Well, if you want to talk about social constructs, I mean, banks are a social construct and a regulatory construct in this highly regulated world that we live in, where banks are the most regulated entities in the economy. So whatever happens to banks, ultimately, it is the regulators that are responsible, because they set the parameters, they give the incentives, they can move them around for good or bad. And sadly, in recent decades, it's been mostly for bad. So as Catherine said, the Silicon Valley bank situation is, you know, it's been very strange, because I mean, you basically have a very unusual, to put it mildly, string of consistently bad bank management decisions taken, which were exacerbated by the regulators and other factors. So started by the decline in deposits that Catherine mentioned. That was in 2022, around $17 billion for Silicon Valley Bank. Now, that can happen for various reasons to any bank, that suddenly there's withdrawal of deposits. I mean, this was drawn out over a year or so. It's a large number. It's unusual. Well, how does a bank react to this? I mean, there's a number of things they could do. They could arrange borrowing from the Fed. They could arrange various government agency deposits. They could arrange liquidity from other banks. But most importantly, what bank management would do is they would go out and market special savings accounts. And if you do this and you're in the top 10 in terms of interest rates you're offering, you will get a wall of money. And I mean, I've studied that closely. And in fact, when banks do this, their main concern is that they may attract too much money, and they will keep these special offerings of interest rates on particular deposits open only for days, because you get so much money coming in. No, they didn't do any of these things. They didn't do any of them. Instead, how do they respond to this, you know, quite possible situation where for some reason deposits are being withdrawn? They sold their best assets, which is the highly liquid and, you know, as is at least measured by regulators, zero risk U.S. treasuries, U.S. government bonds, at a loss. Now, you don't have to book a loss if you're a bank. You can keep them You know, when interest rates go up, all assets, you know, just based on the standard present value calculations, have a nominal loss. But, you know, if you hold to maturity, you will get 100% of your money back. So there is no real loss. And banks can hold to maturity. And so you normally clearly wouldn't sell those and realize losses. But that's what they did. So they took $2 billion in losses, turning notional losses into actual losses when it's been totally unnecessary. They then took the unusual step of advertising this bad management decision, unusual bank management decision, by saying, hey, let's issue some stocks, because then we'll get all the stockbrokers and securities companies and analysts of all the investment houses and fund management companies analyzing our stock offering, and they will all talk about our $2 billion in losses we've made. And it's exactly what happened. So the equity issuance was a failure. That's some more bad sort of negative headlines. And then all you needed was a major depositor, Peter Thiel, who's Silicon Valley major investor, instruct all his entities that he had direct control over and all the companies that he and his companies had invested in to immediately withdraw their money. And he went public and said, we're withdrawing all our money. So that was the Thursday, 17th of March. The stampede was basically started. And now let's also not forget that. So then, in one day, $41 billion or more left the bank. And as Catherine said, it didn't help at all that Silicon Valley Bank had signed up to the Fed Now new settlement system pilot, so that it was no longer in control. And essentially, this was now remote control. In the old days, banks can stop this outflow, like any fund. You know, if you suddenly have too much money being drawn out, then the gates are closed and you stop the outflow and you give people time. In the old days, you'd have a bank holiday. That's why we call it bank holiday, for people to, just calm down a bit. But that wasn't possible. So all the money left. And why was the Federal Reserve created in 1913 against the opinion of very reluctant Congress? And in the end, most people were already on Christmas holiday when the vote was done. But Congress was very reluctant. The main argument in favor of setting up the central bank was that, the best bank, the strongest bank, will get into trouble if there's suddenly a run on its deposits. That's why we need a central bank, Federal Reserve, to step in and make sure that no solvent bank that merely experienced a run on deposits is closed down. Of course, that's been a big lie, because the Fed allowed 10,000 banks plus to go bust in the 1930s. It did not step in. And where was the Fed when Silicon Valley Bank, when this situation happened? It only stepped up after the regulators had taken over. So all this is clearly very, very strange and a very artificial thing. And a few more banks that happened to be quite active in the crypto world were also closed down. Silvergate, Signature Bank, under partly similarly dubious sequence of events. And whereas the majority of banks is, the local lenders and local receivers of deposits, firmly embedded in the community and supported by the community and quite strong and resilient. Now, the whole thing happens, and we have to be aware of this background, in an era where the central planners at the central banks, who are regulators of the banks, have announced already years ago that they have plans to step into the arena, give up their job of being umpires and compete directly against the banks by introducing competition, central bank digital currencies. And it's a fact that actually in the last 30 years, the big central banks have overseen a rapid decline in the number of banks. The ECB under its watch, has killed 5,000 banks. Essentially forced to merge, and they disappear. The smaller ones.
Why do you say the ECB forced it? How did the ECB force this disappearance?
I've spoken, I've spoken to many bankers and bank directors of banks that were essentially pushed into these mergers. I mean, there's almost one every week or every month in Europe. And they all tell me the same thing. There's no choice because of three things. Number one, and this was, of course, until 2020, this very, very low interest rate policy, extremely low, zero negative interest rates. I mean, that's really a big problem for banks. And you flatten the yield curve, you have no more profit margin. Essentially, you're being squeezed out. And at the same time, the regulators stepping up regulatory burdens massively, huge regulatory burdens. And we know, of course, the 2008 crisis was triggered by big banks together with, again, the central bankers and their policies. But it was the small banks that being made to pay for this and suffer because they introduced this Basel III, very complicated, even more complicated regulatory regime. So small banks just need to hire more and more compliance officers. They can't afford this. They're forced to merge. And thirdly, while this is going on and the profit margins are being squeezed and they're having trouble, essentially paying for people to deliver all the bureaucratic reports that they constantly need to deliver to the central banks, the central bankers then do audits all the time and they tell them, well, we think your business model is no longer viable. And you have to prove to us that you're still profitable. Well, you're killing them. And so they actually forced them into property. That's the only thing that was left in Germany for the local banks. And so that, as I've been warning for years, has fueled this property bubble in Germany, which is now also being burst. And therefore, they're now ripe for another banking crisis. But wherever you look, you just see the handwriting of the regulators, of the central planners. They're responsible for all these things that have been happening there.
That's an extremely interesting point. Does the Fed do the same thing? Does it also over-regulate with a view to bringing down these smaller banks? Perhaps, Catherine, you want to answer that.
Yeah, so... It takes a series of regulatory policies that makes it much harder for the banks to operate. So during the low interest period, it was putting pressure on the smaller banks, for example, to invest in long treasuries and not make loans in the community. I do want to point out a perfect example because Richard explained the role of the Fed in protecting banks from these runs. It's important to understand, for example, in Silicon Valley Bank, JP Morgan Chase, who's the second largest owner of the New York Fed, which is the real power in the Fed system, was actively working to pull deposits over as part of the run on the bank. And in fact, was having its office stay open all night to bring deposits across. So you have the second largest owner of the New York Fed, essentially the people who control the Fed, working to vulture deposits from the company that was targeted. You have short sellers making a great deal of money. And according to the American Banking Association, as I said before, starting rumors, during the financial crisis, we know they stopped the short selling, but there was no effort to stop the short selling here. So the relationship between the hedge funds, the rumor campaigns, and the sort of poaching of deposits raises very, very serious questions about whether or not the central bank is encouraging the runs as opposed to, playing the role that it was set up to try and stop these things from going on.
So we have a Fed that was created ostensibly to prevent bank runs causing bank runs. And we have a European Central Bank ostensibly created to keep inflation down, which now regards inflation as a social construct and allows it to rise to 10%. How do we understand that?
Yes, exactly. Well, moving to this topic of inflation, actually, Catherine also had mentioned a key word here, and that is the August 2019 BlackRock proposal to the central bankers gathering at Jackson Hole, where they proposed their going direct plan. Now, what was that plan? And how do we know for sure that it is relevant? Well, the plan, in a way, if you look at it at face value, is slightly surprising because it simply says crises are always happening. There will be another crisis soon. We need to prepare. The Federal Reserve needs to prepare for the coming crisis. And then it says, in the coming crisis, we should create inflation. The goal is, the declared goal of this plan is to create inflation. And how do we do this? And here they are essentially pointing out that the original quantitative easing, which I proposed in Japan in 1995, which consisted of two components. One was to help banks. The central bank cleans up bank balance sheets by purchasing the non-performing assets at face value. That's QE1, let's call it. And then the second step, which I proposed, was to, the banks will still be shell-shocked and they won't lend. And in Japan, they didn't lend for 20 years because they didn't do this policy. But the central bank can kickstart bank credit by forcing money into the economy through the banks, by the central bank purchasing performing assets from non-banks in the economy, just buying things in the economy, whether it's corporate bonds or any asset or even real estate, doesn't matter, because the non-bank sector doesn't have accounts with the central bank. It means the banks will create the credit as they get credited with reserves by the central bank. Anyway, that's the mechanism. That's QE2. And I proposed this in Japan in the 90s for a situation where there's a credit crunch, credit creation shrinking, deflation, the economy shrinking. And it's clear you do want to put money into the system, in circulation, into the real economy. And Bernanke in 2008 adopted QE1, my proposal to clean up the banking system, which worked well. America was, I mean, the Fed was the only central bank to do this. America was the first country to recover after the 2008 crisis quite quickly, despite the fact that the crisis actually started in the US at the time, and Europe took much longer because they didn't take this policy. But then they didn't take the second step. And now this BlackRock proposal is my second part of QE. It's QE2. It's this proposal that the central bank should purchase assets from the non-bank sector directly in the economy. And when you do that, you force banks to create money and push it into the system. And that's what they did, despite the fact, of course, the situation in 2019 and 2020 was very different from Japan, with deflation at the time in Japan. But in the US, we had 5-6% credit growth already in the economy, doing fine. I mean, growth was reasonable. Okay, so then we come to March 2020, and there was this announcement of a flu and the need to lock people down and restrict activity and basically forbid people from going to small and medium-sized enterprises and shops, and essentially give their business to large online companies. Things like that. So all these interventions that you'll remember under the COVID banner. Now, what happened then was, and this obviously is the crisis that the Fed decided it would now use to implement the BlackRock plan. The Fed, and this is how we know for sure that this is what they did, they literally hired BlackRock. They hired BlackRock in March 2020, and they said, we're going to buy assets now from the economy, and that means a lot of hands are needed on deck here to do this. Well, it was your plan. We're going to hire you guys, and you do it for us. So the BlackRock, the biggest asset manager in the world, was hired by the Fed to purchase these assets on behalf of the Fed. And of course, the other reason why we know it is looking at the data. It demonstrates that unlike 2008, we have a massive injection of both central bank credit creation and private bank credit creation, which 2008 was the opposite. Bank credit creation was shrinking, and that's why the Fed stepped in. And then it wasn't money creation. It didn't lead to inflation, as I pointed out at the time, we won't get inflation. This time round, people thought, oh, Fed QE, well, it's not going to cause inflation. We saw it in 2008. Well, it was very different. It's a very different type of QE. It's the QE that if you're already at full employment or the economy is reasonably, you know, supplied with credit creation, if you then massively step up new money creation, of course, you're going to cause inflation, particularly if you then add fiscal programs that make sure people will spend money. And that's what happened. And so that's why since 2020 May, when I got the data, I've been warning quite clearly, this must result in significant inflation 18 months later. And that's what happened. So it was a top-down policy decision to create this inflation. And we need to look no further than the Fed again for the responsibility and the decision makers.
Richard, I realize listening to you that we started to speak without me introducing you properly. You are, of course, as I'm sure everyone has understood, a professor of economics at Lineker College, Oxford, and I believe currently, are you at MCC, at Matthias Corvinus Collegium at the moment in Budapest, or are you still at...
Indeed, I am. Yeah, I am.
Very good. Where yes. I was for 6 months.
Exactly.
I also forgot to say at the beginning that we are joined by two members of the European Parliament, Marcel de Graaf, member of the European Parliament for Forum for Democracy, and by Joachim Kuz, member of the European Parliament for Alternative für Deutschland, for AfD. Both MEPs are obviously more than welcome to jump in whenever they like. And more generally, I would encourage our listeners, if they want to ask questions of either of our two guests, to send in a request to speak. So Joachim and Marcel, please feel free to jump in whenever you like. Catherine, I wanted to go back to you. Richard has just given a very detailed account of how central banks operate and how they are intervening in the market and so on. When we spoke in November, you implied to me, or you said, that in your view, central banks were actually running the world. In other words, that they were not government agencies anymore, but were in fact in charge of the world economy. And of course, we have seen, haven't we, since 2008 at least, that economic policy seems to be reduced to monetary policy. Did I understand you to believe that? Is that your view? And if so, could you explain it to our listeners?
Yes. So I would say they're the bureaucracy that's used to run the world, because much of policy is driven by credit turning on and off. Part of what has happened is we have a central bank of central banks, the Bank of International Settlement in Switzerland, that enjoys sovereign immunity. And through a committee that denotes systemically important, or attributes systemically important status to banks, insurance companies, and payment systems, it looks to me as though we're extending that sovereign immunity to the systemically important institutions. So, for example, in 2012, during the Department of Justice effort to investigate HSBC for clear criminal activities, they decided not to prosecute because it was a systemically important institution. So we're watching a two-tier system emerge where these financial institutions, in essence, enjoy sovereign immunity. The greatest example, John, is that starting in fiscal 1998, the U.S. government and the New York Fed, which is the depository for the U.S. government and provides the primary dealer, runs the primary dealer syndicate, started to operate significantly outside of the financial management laws. And whether under the Constitution or the laws or the regulations, they have been operating so far outside of the financial management laws. I've described it as a financial coup d'etat. And in fact, I've written about that. I came to that conclusion, in fact, after I saw your presentation in London, I think it was in 2001. So this has been going on for a while, but when you operate a government as large as the United States and the largest securities dealer in the world outside of the financial management laws for this period of time, you get an enormous amount of unintended consequences and literally almost a breakaway civilization. Now, that during that period, we've seen all the sovereign governments or most of the sovereign governments of the world take on enormous amounts of debt, which puts them in the debt trap. In the G7 nations, we've been in an economic model where the legislature and voters determine how taxation and fiscal policy is sent, and the central bankers control monetary policy. So you've had a balance of power between the central bankers and the people's representatives, the legislatures. Now what we're seeing is the sovereign nations, you know, move into quote unquote a debt trap. We're watching the central bankers exercise enormous powers. And so if you look at our discussion of the going direct reset, what we see is the central bankers inject $5 trillion, for example, in the United States, which goes to very targeted places, while the vast array of small businesses, communities, civic institutions, and small farms are shut down, making it a field day for the big companies to pick up market share and target and pick up assets cheaply, which they did. And we see an enormous consolidation of wealth, an enormous creation of new billionaires. So you're really watching a game of vulture capitalism. But as you do, you're watching the bankers assert more and more control. Of course, what we most care about is that they are not able to shut off our ability to financially transact without the equivalent of central control in a social credit system. That's the real concern, and that's why there's so much concern now about the move to digital IDs and CBDCs, because as centralized as the system has become, particularly over the last 3 years, once you have complete control of financial transactions in a centralized way, as the head of the BIS has said publicly, they can set the rules and they can enforce the rules centrally. And from everything I've seen them say, they intend to do so.
Did you say vulture capitalism?
Yes. Yeah, so I think what happened with the going direct reset, and, you know, it's half of these policies are described by healthcare policy. Half of them are described as monetary policy, but you have to integrate them and look at them whole. When you inject, and again, I'm using the U.S. example, when you inject $5 trillion from the Fed through asset managers directly into the economy, including creating the kind of whale deposits we see in the banking crisis, you target massive amounts of money into a small number, relatively small number of hands, and then you turn around and you shut down the small business, small enterprise, small civic organization economy. You shut down community and Main Street. It makes a field day. So the enormous amounts of sales shift to the big publicly traded firms, and the investors or the big publicly traded firms are now in a position to pick up enormous amounts of real estate and other assets, not just market share, but, you know, people are having to sell assets to keep their business going or to keep their family going while their business is shut down. So it was the most extraordinary example of vulture capitalism we've seen yet.
I can see we've got a question from one of our, sorry, Marcel, do you want to say
something?
Marcel de Graaf, MEP.
Yes, I'm listening with very big interest in everything that you're saying, because this is, of course, an expertise where an ordinary politician is not so much familiar with. But still, it makes, to me at least, very clear that the checks and balances in our democracies are at stake at this moment. Because if you look at how it's working in politics, it are again also this big capital that are, you might say, more or less owning the politicians. So it's becoming like an incestuous game between the big capital and the politicians, which enforces this whole system, basically accumulating more and more power in less and less hands. So it's, to me, it's also making clear that it's a threat to democracy itself. Thank you.
I'm sure.
Can I just jump in?
Joachim Kuhs, MEP, please go
ahead. I would like to stress that what Marcel has said. For me, it's a big, really, it's a big issue. I'm a member of the Budgetary Control Committee, and as such a member, we have the limited control possibilities for the bank, the European Investment Bank. You know, that's one another one. It's not the ECB; it's the European Investment Bank. But this say we want to have a full control of what they are investing, especially when we get to the new money for recovery and resilience for funds and so on. It's 750 billion euros who are on the table, and they don't want a control on these things. And that's one thing which is very annoying for me. And the other thing I'm seeing more and more is that banks are forgetting what they are normally, what they have principles or sound financial management and so on. And they are leaving these things and are going for new objectives. It's the new objectives are creating a climate bank, a green bank, or to have a moral bank, yeah, where all things which are not, which are against the rules, they are self-giving them. It's not democratic. It's only self-imposed systems and self-imposed rules. And they are creating their own system in some sense. And that's, for me, really disturbing for our future. Thank you.
Exactly. Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Jenny, very much, Joachim. Richard, do you want to respond to that? We've got a couple of questions from listeners.
Yes, but
do you want to respond? Go ahead.
Comment. It's exactly that is the issue that, in the past, banks do have power because they make this decision who will get new money. Then bank lending is money creation. And so when banks give out a loan, the money for the loan is not existing money. It's actually newly added to the money supply. And that, of course, has an economic impact, and therefore their decisions do shape the economic landscape. And essentially, the banks in the past had been told by the regulators, you just go out and make money, which in many countries has led to big problems, because you essentially, as banks get bigger and concentration in the banking system increases, the big banks want to do big deals. They therefore increasingly lend for asset purchases, property lending, financial assets, and then you get asset inflation because it's money creation. These loans are not sustainable. They don't generate income streams to service and repay those loans, and therefore you only have capital gains that in the short term during the asset inflation looks great for everyone, but it's a Ponzi scheme, a pyramid scheme, a snowball system. Basically, the moment banks then stop lending for asset purchases, for property, real estate purchases, then the property bubble and the asset bubble bursts, and then you get non-performing loans and the banking crisis. And it's always the same. Now, Germany was quite resilient because it has the largest number of banks in Europe, and the majority is small local banks, like in the US, like in China. And that's a resilient system because small banks lend to small firms, and that mainly means productive business investment for generating jobs, implementing new technologies, increasing productivity. So productivity is usually high, exports are strong as a result. And that system, though, has been damaged significantly by the ECB and its policies. And so now they're forced to merge in Germany, and they already have been forced for the last 10 years to lend to property because the normal productive business lending was made unproductive by the regulators. So ultimately, it's been true that the regulators, the central planners, have been very much in control of where the money goes. And this is now becoming more explicit as they're imposing top-down these climate rules for lending. It just makes it obvious that really what they want to do is a Soviet-style top-down central planning system where you're only allowed to do what is specifically permitted at the moment. What is the current sort of politically favored trend that will be allowed. And whereas if you're then critical of the system, of course, like in the Soviet Union, your funding will be cut. And we saw that in action in Ottawa, the demonstrators against the lockdown policies of the Canadian government. There were peaceful democratic demonstrations, but the government, of course, didn't like it. And in the end, they passed a law to allow the government to tell the banks to shut down demonstrators access to money, and then that's how they ended these demonstrations. And of course, that shows what's going to happen with CBDCs. But let's not forget they're already using these powers, as was just mentioned, by already telling banks you have to look at climate targets and these and those targets, and which is essentially central planning interference in what used to be a decentralized and basically business-oriented process that in countries with many small banks was working quite well and avoided big problems for a century in Germany, for example.
Now, we had a question from Reg. I'm not sure if he's still with us. Reg, are you there? And if so, do you want to ask your question? If not, you can come back anytime, Reg. I think we may have made you wait too long, and I'm sorry for that. But Richard, I wanted to come back to the issue that you raised in your earlier answer. And for the benefit of our listeners, could I say this is not intended to be rude, but when you talk about asset inflation and asset bubbles and investment in real estate and so on, as you well know, what that means is young people can't afford somewhere to live. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about when we talk about property inflation or speculative bubbles in real estate, what that concretely means is that someone who is age 20 or even 30 today in Europe and probably in the United States, they can have an iPhone, they can go on a cheap flight to the Mediterranean or whatever, but they have affordable luxuries and unaffordable necessities.
Very true.
And this is one of the most horrific aspects about inflation. Inflation and all these discussions tend to have a rather arid and technical appearance when they're expressed in the vocabulary of economics, but they translate into very real social problems. We are faced now, I'm sure you'll agree with me, with this spiral now, which in the case of some countries, Britain, for example, has been in place now for generations, where, of course, the property inflation has been out of control, I would say, since the 1971 closure of the gold window.
Indeed.
That may be true of other countries. But this is not a technical matter. This translates into people being unable to get married and have children. And so I wanted to ask you about inflation. And we were discussing with Catherine just now, and I'm sure Catherine will have a view on this. Catherine's view, obviously, is that the central bankers and the administration behind them run the world. And that Catherine, you said that governments have put themselves into a debt trap. That's absolutely true. We've seen that, of course, in the States last week, where the debt ceiling was raised yet again. My question to both of you is, and I suspect the answer to this is yes, because of what you said earlier, Richard, about the remark made by the ECB official about inflation being a social construct. This coming from a bank which has low inflation written into its very charter. Is the inflation that we are currently seeing not a deliberate policy to impoverish the population, but to get out of the debt trap? Is it not the natural, inevitable result of the debt trap?
It definitely is a deliberate policy. And you mentioned the UK, and the UK is case in point. That's a sort of system where there have been boom-bust cycles for a long time, and asset inflation, property price is so high, it's very hard for younger people to get their property, to own property. But then again, look at Germany. Until the introduction of the ECB, there hadn't been a property bubble in Germany. And property prices were very stable and very modest, and people could afford to buy property. In fact, property was so sort of boring that partly as a result, people were renting a lot and they saw no need to buy it. But then the ECB was introduced, and of course the ECB created bank credit driven property price bubbles, banking crises and significant recession in two stages. First, the periphery, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Greece. Massive havoc created by the ECB's credit creation policies. And because the ECB is a fair central bank, it was clear that it was going to be the time of the center now, after they'd completely destroyed the economic balance in the periphery. And so it was Germany's time to have a property bubble and what follows from this, which will always be the same. So the German banks are likely in the next 5 years to be massively affected, and there'll be a huge wave of further bank mergers amidst the banking crisis, which was engineered by the central bank. None of that is necessary. We can have stable growth without inflation and without boom-bust cycles and property prices being too high. It is possible. I mean, one very simple small policy you can take at any time is to have a rule that banks are not allowed to lend for transactions that don't contribute to the economy, which is asset transactions. And so how do young people then get their mortgage? Well, you set up non-bank mortgage companies which don't have the power to create money, and there they're funded, therefore, with existing money, and then you won't get asset inflation. That's always been possible. Of course, the central bankers that make the decisions are very much aware of that, and their revealed preference has been to create these boom-bust cycles with crises, because that's how they push through the political and systemic changes they want to push through, which always involve increasing their power. And now they're in the last stage where they want to introduce their CBDCs. The Bundesbank was a big problem for them because it, you know, throughout its existence until it was essentially, you know, castrated under the ECB 23 years ago, the Bundesbank didn't play this game. Here was a central bank that literally worked hard to maintain low inflation and help the economy grow and do what do you think a central bank should be doing, while the other central banks were playing these boom-bust games. And so it was necessary to get rid of this Bundesbank. Now, because its policies were so successful, many European countries voluntarily joined the Bundesbank policies and linked their exchange rates, their currencies, to the Deutsche Mark currency. And so what then happened around the year 2000 was the abolition of the de facto European currency, which was the D-mark, which had been forged through economic performance and voluntary decisions by in the markets, and introduce a foreign currency, the euro, which is not everyone's foreign currency, and an institution that's above the law, the ECB, an international organization. Prosecutors can't get any documents or arrest anyone. In Nigeria, you know, they just arrested the central bank governor for his outrageous attempt to abolish cash suddenly, like they did in India years ago, the demonetization, while pushing through CBDCs. And that was a failure, fortunately. And they've arrested the central bank governor. Well, the ECB bureaucrats are not afraid of the police coming in because it's international foreign territory, even though it's in Frankfurt. When there's a fire alarm in the ECB building going off, the Frankfurt fire brigades weren't allowed in because it's foreign territory. So they are able to implement policies that have serious negative consequences for all of us in Europe with impunity.
That is, of course, the characteristic of all international organizations, because by definition, no international organization is ever accountable to the people over whom it wields power. That goes for international tribunals. It goes, obviously, for the European Commission and the rest of the European Union. It goes for the UN and so on. Now, we have a question from Rolla. Rolla, would you like to go ahead and ask your question?
I don't have a question. I just have a small observation. Hi, Richard. Thank you, Richard. I'm an avid reader of your content. Thank you so much for a lot of, you know, content that you provide us. So my quick observation is I think there's something seriously flawed with the finance system globally. If, as a startup, if I approach, you know, investors or the bank, you know, with some imaginary figures, I can, you know, fairly easily acquire a loan of like or a credit line of $2 to $3-5 million or euros. And if it was a small business with some serious intentions, which can employ 5-10 people and can survive another 10-15 years, approach the bank or investors, I would barely find any, you know, any interest from the investors or angels or the banks. I would be, you know, mostly denied. My case would be denied. So, and those startups, 98-99%, we have seen historically, there's a data available that they are going to disappear from the market within 2 or 3 years. So I think, you know, we all know in any given economy in the West or in the East, small and medium-sized businesses, they create employment. Small banks, they are actually created for support, you know, to support these small businesses or medium-sized businesses. That is all. The system is all, you know, I think seriously flawed. It is just disappearing. Companies, organizations, banks, they all favor, you know, fancy startups which have some imaginary figures, and they just disappear after 2-3 years after burning a couple of $1 million. That's my, you know, simple observation.
Yes, yes. And so the insight from that is that really we need to shape our financial system so that we have decentralized decision making by many small banks, because when a bank is small, it can't lend to big companies and it is interested in lending to small firms. And in addition, you can introduce, as they did in Germany, the rule that the community banks, which is 80% of the banks in Germany, cooperative or savings banks, they're forced to stick to their local geographically restricted area and they will not lend outside that area. And as a result, if you are a small firm in that area, they will look at you and they want to help you. They want to lend to small firms. That's their market and they will. So these are the type of banks we need to create everywhere across the globe. Then we, as a result, in aggregate, you get a very decentralized money creation process based on, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of local loan offices making local decisions, talking to small firms. But if you have a centralized, concentrated financial system with, say, 5 big banks and a central bank, and of course the central banks want to further concentrate that even more, you will get essentially a Soviet-style system with top-down money creation, top-down decisions by central planners, which is essentially a recipe for disaster.
We've got one another question from a listener, and then I want to go to Catherine for a final question. The question from the listener comes from Not That Bad. Go ahead,
John. May I have a brief query?
Is that Rolla? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, a very brief query. You know, how do we see the emergence of crypto banks or the digital banks? You know, that have come up in the last 5-6 years. How should we see them?
I'm going to ask Catherine almost exactly that question, but our earlier listener, who goes by the name of Not That Bad, seems to have gone away. Maybe we can conclude with that question to you, Catherine. Richard has just said we need to move to or back towards small banks. If the currency is being debased, as it is, and if central control is becoming all ever more threatening for individual liberties, how do we create inflation-proof and regulation-proof small local banking systems? Catherine?
So there are many ways to do it, but the great thing is to do what we can do today as quickly as possible. If you look at what the consumer choices are making, we have the ability to shift our money out of the large banks that are the principal owners or controllers of the central banks. So we can shift our deposits significantly and make it much easier for the community bankers to either build their banks or create new banks. The second thing we can do is we can bring transparency. So just as you're doing today, John, with a podcast like these, it's very important. You know, I think there's been an effort to sort of steal banks in the United States. And I think a lot of the transparency that's come out in the last 2 months has made it much harder to do it. The third thing we can do is make sure we protect the cash system. Richard just mentioned the governor of the Nigerian Central Bank being arrested. Great backlash against his trying to stop cash. And we've seen a real push for the last 2 years to roll back the digital systems and replenish the analog systems, and first and foremost by using cash. We see referendums to try and protect the use of cash. We see state governments in the United States move to ensure that cash is taken. The one thing that government can do, because we do have government representatives here, is it's exceptionally important that sovereign governments have the ability to control their banking, their banking depository, and make sure their systems can't be manipulated or shut off. Richard just wrote a great memo, a memorandum for the legislators in Tennessee on the importance of a state sovereign bank. But anything municipalities, countries, governments can do to protect their internal financial transaction freedom will translate in helping the citizens do the same. So I would encourage you to think about where are the political leaders who can help you make sure that your transaction freedom and the government's transaction freedom is protected. Our big risk here is this is going to come down to taxation. Do the bankers control the taxes being paid, or do the sovereign governments control the taxes and the bank accounts that the taxes roll in on? Because if we can't protect the tax flows under the control of our representatives, then the central bankers will collapse the legislative part of the house and assert complete control.
Richard, sorry, do you want to respond? Because I've got a follow up question.
I would agree. I would agree. There is a backlash, but we are the backlash. You know, we have to work on this. We can't sit back and say, "Oh, somebody is going to slow this." Like fortunately in Nigeria, we can't rely on that. Particularly in Europe, I see how the institutions that have been created for the last, more than half a century, have been quite successfully restricting people's actual, room for maneuver against top-down impositions of bad policies. And also psychologically, they've been very much sort of put into a state where they, some kind of stupor, where they're not really standing up against things. That's quite strong, quite powerful in Europe. So I think we do need to work hard to wake people up and also help people get empowered. The people are the sovereign. From 2020, we saw that actually there is some kind of external force that is able to coordinate governments of so many countries to adopt policies that suddenly overthrow, for example, medical procedures and medical wisdom, and impose very draconian restrictions, disastrous policies, and yet they're all adopting the very same policy. So there is this force that has established itself and essentially seems to be able to control our governments. Well, it's really important that we stand up and get back control. There was a proposal in the German parliament to introduce Swiss-style referendums in Germany as well, which would be wonderful. We haven't had such a democracy in the entire post-war era, and that would be great. Also, unfortunately, it was turned down by the ruling parties, but we need to keep pushing on that. Also, we have technology. Why isn't that technology being used to improve the degree of democracy? Instead, it's being turned against the people to monitor us, to survey us, to control us, to manipulate us, to nudge us, all this psychological procedures, technology and knowledge and information is used against us. Well, it should be used for us, and we should insist on this. We could vote through our phones on almost anything on a weekly basis. That would be democracy. Well, what's bad about that, to introduce democracy?
Well, that rhetorical question is a good moment to end. I like to keep these spaces to 1 hour. You've mentioned referendums. Referendums are an absolute core policy of Forum for Democracy, which has called for them repeatedly in the Netherlands. They did, of course, exist in the Netherlands. There was a provision in the constitution for citizens' referendums to be launched, and that happened in 2016 when Thierry Baudet, the party leader, or the then future party leader, launched a referendum on the association agreement with Ukraine, which he won. Forum for Democracy won a handsome victory. And what did Europe do? Well, it simply ignored the result. So, and not only did it ignore the result and ratify the, not only did the Netherlands ignore the result and ratify the association agreement anyway, but it then removed from its constitution this provision for citizens' referendums. So we're a long way, unfortunately, from achieving what is indeed a very desirable goal. Richard Wellner, thank you so much. Catherine, thank you so much for giving your time. Catherine Austin-Fitz and Richard Wellner. Thank you also to Marcel de Graaf and to Joachim Kuz, members of the European Parliament. Please, everybody, follow us on Twitter, FVD_INTL. And visit our page, fedinternational.com, and sign up to the FED International weekly newsletter. Thank you very much, all of you. Thank you to our speakers. Thank you to our listeners. And enjoy the rest of your week. Goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. And goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, guys.